him until now. So ISIS, al-Nusra, and the Assad was all against the real people, the activists who were having their own dream about the freedom and the democracy. And this is what why the revolution started, and this is what we still need until now. And, you know, it's more about, like, controlling the violence that was happening. And just the idea about we left Syria 3 years ago. We were displaced out of Aleppo. And we've had all this experience about the shelling, bombing, and every bad situation, the siege, and the threatened to be death or displaced. And now, 3 years later, the same scenario happening again in the last place in Idlib, which is, like, just unbelievable that how the world's still watching this and just speak about ISIS, which is really did nothing comparing with the regime violence. And if we just go to any center which they document all this death and like bad crimes.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll do part two, put it online at democracynow.org. Wa'ad al-Khatib and Hamza al-Khatib. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Literary Arts, presenting author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, in celebration of his new book, The Water Dancer, Monday, October 21st at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, in conversation with author Renee Watson. Tickets and more information at literaryarts.org.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are thrilled to present the 39th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, July 19, 20, and 21 at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The area's finest jazz, blues, R&B, and Latin musicians will rock the park for 3 days. PDX Soul, Karen Lovely, King Louis Organ Trio, Devin Phillips, Mel Brown, John Gilmore are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 39th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Portland's longest-running community event, July 19, 20, and 21, under the St. John's Bridge in North Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Jana Jihad Tamimi, 13-year-old Palestinian activist, began recording, reporting on, and sharing her lived reality from the age of 7, shortly after two of her relatives were killed by Israeli forces. Jana now enjoys a global following, serves as ambassador of the South African Palestinian Children's Initiative, and has been awarded internationally for her media role. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, a Portland leader lashes out against plans to use boulders to keep the houseless from camping.
An Oregon senator leads an effort to help address both climate change and income inequality.
And Oregon communities win money to help make themselves more friendly to people of all ages.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 18th, 2019. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Annette Newell. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty filmed a YouTube video statement against the Oregon Department of Transportation's decision to install boulders to prevent houseless people from camping.
Where I'm standing is ODOT property. ODOT is using our transportation dollars to put boulders down in areas where they are not using the land. They are displacing people who have nowhere to go, and they're pushing them into the neighborhood. So of course that means the neighbors start complaining that they have houseless people outside their community. Is this a good use of your transportation dollars? I am outraged that we're using public money to displace people that we cannot provide housing for. ODOT, how about providing some tents? How about some tiny houses, right? How about working with the community to help us solve our houseless problem, rather than using our precious transportation dollars that, by the way, we could be putting more public transit in to actually displace people who already have been displaced. I am absolutely outraged. We can do better. If you agree with me, you need to contact ODOT and tell ODOT to cut this stuff out. We need housing. We don't need boulders. Thank you.
And again, that was Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty. ODOT spokesman Don Hamilton responded that the state is using the big rocks to save money from sweeps and also to keep houseless people safe from the dangers of being near a freeway. He says, quote, when these campers are next to the highway like that, they're really putting themselves in danger, and we have to make sure they're not in jeopardy. Hamilton says the state is, quote, probably going to be spending upwards of $1 million on the boulders.
First, Portland police said they wouldn't participate in raids targeting illegal undocumented immigrants. Now, the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office is doing the same. Sheriff Mike Reese issued a statement this afternoon. He says, quote, I'm proud of MCSO's relationship with the immigrant and refugee community. We work hard every day to build trust with these communities and will continue to do so. We're here to serve all members of our community, regardless of immigration status. Please call us in case of an emergency to report a crime or to find a missing person. Sheriff's deputies will not ask anyone about their immigration status. The sheriff's office says in the current political climate, refugees and immigrants may fear and distrust law enforcement officers, but they say they want to ensure that people know the Multnomah Sheriff's Office does not enforce federal immigration law or have authority in deportation. Their current policy states, quote, because of state law, MCSO must draw a bright line with regard to the work of the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. MCSO's mission does not encompass the enforcement of federal immigration law.
And some Oregon lawmakers have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the federal government's treatment of undocumented immigrants at the border. The state itself has sanctuary policies meant to protect the undocumented, and as we just mentioned, Portland Police and Multnomah County Sheriff's Office even went as far to announce they would not help immigration and customs enforcement officers. However, Oregon invests its public pension funds into the private prison companies that are detaining immigrants. In fact, it's invested more than most states. The Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund has invested at least $2.1 million into shares of two government companies that build and operate immigrant detention camps.
Think of how many boulders they could buy with that $2.1 million. Yeah, I just had really. To say. Okay, climate change and income inequality, two of the biggest problems affecting our world and communities. Today, one of Oregon's U.S. senators announced a plan to help address both. Democrat Jeff Merkley, along with other lawmakers and labor and environmental leaders, debuted the Good Jobs for 21st Century Energy Act.
We have a significant challenge ahead of us. We're in a rapidly changing world with a rapidly changing energy economy. And the question is, where will America be in all of this? Will we as a nation be left behind? And will American workers be left behind? Or will we fight to have a vibrant, thriving new energy sector and to have good paying, good benefits, jobs for American workers? We have to fight to make this happen. We have an opportunity for our workers, our communities, for American ingenuity, an opportunity for American leadership and innovation, an opportunity for communities that have been left behind in the past or being left behind now in this transition. It's an opportunity to create good family wage jobs. I'm the son of a union machinist. My dad was millwright in a timber mill. When the timber mill went out of business, it affected the entire town. Bit of the experience we're seeing throughout the economy as the energy economy changes. And as the son of a union machinist, I know there's no substitute for the foundation for a family for than a good paying job. and I still live in a blue-collar community. Today, fewer of my neighbors have the opportunities that my family had. There's a lot of part-time jobs, a lot of jobs with no benefits, a lot of putting several part-time jobs together and worrying about the conflict in schedule, and you're always on the verge of being fired. Those are not the type of jobs that create a family foundation or foundation for families to thrive. So let's seize the opportunity here in America as we embrace the changing energy. It's time we have a race to the top in terms of jobs for American workers, not a race to the bottom where workers are minimized, squeezed, and families are left without a foundation to succeed. We're brand new off the block. Right now we have 10 colleagues who are co-sponsors. We do not yet have Republican colleagues who are sponsoring, but we hope to engage them, because the idea of having a good environment and good paying jobs should be an American ideal, not a red and blue issue.
That was U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley announcing the Good Jobs for 21st Century Energy Act. Stay tuned for KBOO News In-Depth coming up later this hour for more on that story.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler testified yesterday before a panel of U.S. Senate Democrats on the Special Committee on the Climate Crisis about what the city is doing to fight climate change. Wheeler was one of only five mayors of major U.S. cities to testify in Washington. In 2017, Wheeler joined 50 mayors across the country, signing a charter committing their cities to emissions reductions. Per-person carbon emissions in the city have fallen substantially since 2000, but the city's transportation pollution has increased by 6.4% in the last year.
A scorecard is spurring Washington cities to do more to control stormwater pollution. As KBOO's Kenzie Beard reports, about a third of Western Washington municipalities are making progress towards controlling polluting stormwater runoff.
After years of work, cities in Washington are doing more to protect the Puget Sound from its biggest source of pollution, stormwater runoff. A report from the Puget Sound Alliance and Washington Environmental Council helped motivate them. In 2017, the groups released their progress rating, called Nature's Scorecard, for 83 Puget Sound municipalities to measure how they were meeting 2012 codes to reduce toxic stormwater. It found fewer than half of them were making meaningful progress.
After we published that scorecard, we got some more municipalities reaching back out to us and a little more willing to work with us after actually seeing their scores. And so we continued to reach out and work with them.
Says Alyssa Barton, policy manager for the Alliance. In the 2019 scorecard released this month, nearly three-quarters of the municipalities are making meaningful progress. The analysis gauges how towns and cities are doing based off of five State Department of Ecology measures for stormwater permitting, such as improving filtration and planting native trees to filter pollutants. Barton notes that reducing Puget Sound pollution is beneficial for people as well as wildlife, including salmon health and orca recovery. Linden is one of the municipalities that made big strides after the 2017 scorecard. The small town in Northwest Washington went from not meeting any of the standards to meeting all five. Linden City Planning Director Heidi Good said that folks working for small towns have to wear a lot of hats, and they received help from stormwater permitting consultants to do this work.
As a small town, it's really difficult to track all of those different markers as far as stormwater is concerned and site design and landscape and natural environment, but we're really stepping up our game in all areas.
The Nature Scorecard released also coincides with updated stormwater permit requirements from the State Department of Ecology. Abby Stockwell, a municipal stormwater permit planner for the agency, says one of the biggest updates is to the source of control of pollution.
It's really about preventing pollution from entering these stormwater systems, which are draining directly to creeks and the Puget Sound and the rivers. There's no treatment involved before it hits these receiving waters.
While most have improved, about 16% of municipalities haven't made any progress since 2012. For KBOO News, I'm Mackenzie Beard.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the rollout of a bill aimed at fighting climate change and helping America's workers. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, listen to Popular Education. Then at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy, down to 55. Tomorrow, we'll see some bright sunshine, a high of 78. Then for the weekend, the sunny skies continue, warming up to the high 80s. And today in history, on this date in 1947, President Harry Truman signed a Presidential Succession Act, which placed the Speaker of the House and the Senate President pro tempore next in the line of succession after the Vice President. We have two quotes from Truman, who said, "When even one American who has done nothing wrong is forced by fear to shut his mind and close his mouth, then all Americans are in peril." He also said, "I never gave anybody hell. I just told the truth, and they thought it was hell."
A revitalization project in downtown Salem is one of the winners of a special grant program from AARP. Eric Tegetoff has the story.
Three community projects in Oregon have been selected to receive grants from the 2019 AARP Community Challenge Program. The program awards funding for proposals that make cities more livable for people of all ages. Among the winners is the City of Salem and Center 50 Plus, which will hold summer pop-up programs downtown and provide intergenerational classes in a vacant storefront. AARP Oregon State Director Ruby Houghton-Pitts says the project is an opportunity to revitalize the capital city.
In our downtown areas where we had our shops and restaurants and all of that are starting to come back. And so anything that we can do to make those areas safe, more walkable, affordable, and accessible really does improve a community.
Other recipients include Talent Maker City, which offers intergenerational workshops for skills such as carpentry, ceramics, and screen printing, and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, which will pilot a program in Portland's J District to help the community's elders use technology for mobility around town. The J District is one of the most diverse communities in the city, and also a low-income neighborhood. Houghton-Pitts says these grants can jumpstart community improvement efforts.
What kinds of things can we do that are creative and innovative, and we can do in a short amount of time with a little bit of money? You know, these are not huge grants, but a little bit of money goes a long way when you're trying to complete something or when you're trying to pilot something.
The program is offering nearly $1.6 million in grants to 159 projects across the country. The projects must be completed by November 4th. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegetoff.
Billionaire and creator of Tesla and SpaceX, Elon Musk, wants to control our brains. His idea is to insert Bluetooth implants because he says they could enable motor functions for people with injuries. The tiny chip attached to the brain would consist of 1,000 wires measuring a tenth of a human hair. The device is for stroke victims, cancer patients, or those seeking a memory boost. The chip would connect using a USB cord that users can control by iPhone. Musk's objective is, quote, to use artificial intelligence to have a positive effect on humanity. Tests for the new devices will begin before 2021.
In Bulgaria, a country with only 7 million people, 5 million people have become victims of a hack into the country's national tax agency. The hacker stole their names, addresses, incomes, and social security information. The genius criminal hacker? A 20-year-old computer programmer, so authorities think. While the investigation into the hack is still in its early stages, some speculate that Russia may have had something to do with it as retaliation after Bulgaria bought American-made fighter jets. The world of cyber attacks can blur the lines between criminals, countries, and corporations, leaving investigators wondering how to defend national security in person and online.
Overdose deaths decreased last year for the first time in decades, statistics show. Last year, there were 68,000 of these deaths reported in the U.S. They've been increasing each year since 1996 because of the prescription drug epidemic when OxyContin was introduced. Researchers also found a drop in the use of heroin and painkillers, yet an increase in stimulants like cocaine. Although the rates were not as high as last year, it's still seven times higher than a generation ago.
And in New York today, a judge denied bail for financier and registered sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The judge found $70,000 in cash, diamonds, and an Austrian passport that had a false name. Prosecutors displayed evidence that he was a flight risk, and many accusers also stated he's a danger to young women and children. He was arrested in early July for charges of sex trafficking and conspiracy. The allegation stated he abused underage girls at his homes in New York and Florida for 3 years. He's currently in jail and faces up to 45 years in prison.
Three Republicans joined 230 Democrats in the House of Representatives to pass the first federal minimum wage increase in a decade. Raise the Wage Act would guarantee all American workers a minimum wage of $15. Republicans in the House likened the bill's passing to, quote, sacrificing the wages, families, and livelihoods of American workers upon the altar of socialist ideology. Legislators were joined by workers, business owners, and labor rights activists for the vote, who erupted into cheers after its passing was announced. The Raise the Wage Act is now heading to the Republican-controlled Senate.
The World Health Organization has declared a global emergency for the Ebola outbreak that's affected the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. The WHO says infection has spread to 2,500 people. Half have died. Ebola is a virus that spreads through body fluids, and many victims bleed externally and internally. It kills half of those who get it. There's a treatment that's 99% effective. However, not everyone's vaccinated. Experts say it's becoming harder to monitor the virus because it's spreading rapidly.
A recent memo details a plan to send $40 million in aid to Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido. KBOO's Alex Connor has more.
A leaked USAID memo obtained by the LA Times shows that the Trump administration is planning to divert more than $40 million in humanitarian aid that was destined for Guatemala and Honduras to Venezuela's U.S.-backed opposition. The $41.9 million being diverted will go to opposition leader Juan Guaido to pay supporters' salaries and airfare, as well as for propaganda, technical election assistance, and other, quote, democracy-building projects. President Trump said he has planned to cut all aid to Central America until countries have stopped the flow of migrants coming across the U.S. border, though critics say that ending that aid would be counterproductive because the conditions that have caused so many people to flee their homes and loved ones would only get worse. Living conditions in Guatemala and Honduras have become increasingly harsh for many people over the past decade, with rampant poverty, instability, and violence stemming in no small part from a century of U.S.-backed coups and unethical trade partnerships, which have served to plunder many of the region's natural resources. This adversity has been compounded by climate change and a recent drought, which has left much of Central America starving. The real humanitarian crisis, however, according to the Trump administration, is in Venezuela, where a socialist government has thus far been unwilling to sign away their oil reserves to foreign corporate interests, and where direct U.S. intervention in the form of sanctions and asset freezes have led to food and medical shortages and an 80% rise in the cost of living over the past 2 years, which has led millions of Venezuelans to seek refuge in neighboring Colombia. The sum of money to be diverted from humanitarian aid in Guatemala and Honduras is curiously close to the sum that military contractor and former Blackwater CEO Eric Prince was reportedly seeking to obtain from frozen Venezuelan assets in April, which would be illegal unless or until Venezuela and the United States are in open conflict. If the money from USAID is to be diverted to Guaido and his supporters to help fund an overthrow of the current government in Venezuela, it will have to happen before the current fiscal year ends in September and a new budget is created. It remains possible for House members to stall the transfer until then, but whether or not the issue remains in the public's consciousness could help determine their willingness to do so. For KBOO News, this is Alex Connor.
Poland's Gazeta Polska newspaper has announced its next issue will come with an LGBTQ free zone sticker. The conservative newspaper reaches about 110,000 people. A preview of the sticker on social media shows a black cross over a rainbow flag. Several high-ranking leaders in Poland, including the U.S. ambassador, have expressed disdain for the sticker, saying it promotes hate. Paweł Rawia, the deputy mayor of Warsaw, plans on filing a complaint about the stickers to a prosecutor, saying, quote, German fascists created Jew-free zones. Same-sex marriage is still banned in Poland.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. One of the leaders of demonstrators blocking access to Mauna Kea for construction of the 30-meter telescope responded to Wednesday's arrests of 33 people and the governor of Hawaii's emergency proclamation. Kahukahi Kanuha, in a press conference streamed on social media by the group, says the standoff and arrests were peaceful. He calls Governor David Ige's move irresponsible.
How do you justify this type of money, this type of budgeting, this type of mobilization of law enforcement, when the people of Hawaii have made it extremely, extremely clear that we are not going to allow the desecration of our mauna? We're not going to allow it anymore.
The governor's emergency proclamation allows for the activation of National Guard units and allows law enforcement to close down areas and roads. Native Hawaiians and their allies started the demonstration Monday and have vowed to stay to protect the site they hold sacred. The state says it will move forward with the project, and safety is of top concern. The Oglala Sioux tribe has officially recognized same-sex marriage on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. China Lockett has more.
Recognizing same-sex marriage on the Pine Ridge Reservation is part of a push to create inclusivity. Chase Iron Eyes is the communications manager for Oglala Lakota Sioux Tribal President Julian Running Bear. Iron Eyes says proponents of the ordinance gathered information from locals that helped convince tribal officials to pass it.
We were alarmed to find out that six people had committed suicide in our homelands since May of 2019, and 66% of those suicides were people that were discriminated against or bullied or bashed or targeted on the basis of their gender or the way they were born or the way they identify or however you want to look at that.
Iron Eye says those findings represent a crisis in the community.
The thing that triggered us is knowing about that our young people are being bullied or bashed or that they're having their self-esteem impacted.
The tribe is also looking to adopt an anti-hate crime resolution modeled after the Matthew Shepard Act.
They want to operate a hotline. You know what I mean? It's not just the legislation. It's actually doing something in the community to build a foundation to create some capacity.
Iron Eye says the tribal president's office is also looking for ways to provide funding for suicide prevention resources. For National Native News, I'm Trina Lockett in Rapid City.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs has passed legislation to extend funding for tribal water rights settlements. Von Golden reports from Washington.
The Indian Water Rights Settlement Extension Act would remove the end date for a fund that allows the federal government to broker deals to protect water resources and build infrastructure on and around tribal territory. The fund was set to expire in 2029, but these settlements take a long time, and the costs are planned out for extended periods of time, too. That means most of the rest of the settlement fund was already divvied out until it was set to expire in 2029. The new legislation removes that expiration date entirely, allowing tribes and federal authorities certainty that new settlements could be funded. Democratic New Mexico Senator Tom Udall sponsored the bill, but it also had bipartisan support.
I think we've done all our homework, and we had very good assistance and help from the Republican members of the committee.
And it will need continued bipartisan support to get the bill onto the Republican-held Senate floor for a vote. For National Native News from Capitol Hill, I'm Vaughn Golden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 18th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Imara Moore, Kenzie Beard, and Alex Connor. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Randall Rigo. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is myself, Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Income inequality and climate change, two issues we often take a deep dive into here at KBOO. Today, Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley joined other lawmakers and labor and environmental leaders to announce their solution for both. They're calling it the Good Jobs for 21st Century Energy Act, which they hope will drive good family wage jobs into America's clean energy industry. Here's part of that announcement, starting off with Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley.
Thank you, everyone, for coming in and joining us for the kickoff of the Good Jobs 21st Century Energy Act. I'm pleased to be here with my Senate colleagues, the environmental community, the labor community, all working together to create this vision for the future. And a particular thanks to Richard for being here as a champion for workers across America for decades. So thank you for joining us. We have a significant challenge ahead of us. We're in a rapidly changing world with a rapidly changing energy economy. And the question is, where will America be in all of this? Will we as a nation be left behind? And will American workers be left behind? Or will we fight to have a vibrant, thriving new energy sector and to have good paying, good benefits, jobs for American workers? We have to fight to make this happen. We have an opportunity for our workers, our communities, for American ingenuity, an opportunity for American leadership and innovation, an opportunity for communities that have been left behind in the past or being left behind now in this transition. It's an opportunity to create good family wage jobs. I'm the son of a union machinist. My dad was millwright in a timber mill. When the timber mill went out of business, it affected the entire town. Bit of the experience we're seeing throughout the economy as the energy economy changes. And as the son of a union machinist, I know there's no substitute for the foundation for a family than a good paying job. And I still live in a blue collar community. Today, fewer of my neighbors have the opportunities that my family had. There's a lot of part-time jobs, a lot of jobs with no benefits, a lot of putting several part-time jobs together and worrying about the conflict in schedule, and you're always on the verge of being fired. Those are not the type of jobs that create a family foundation for families to thrive. So let's seize the opportunity here in America as we embrace the changing energy economy. Let's have America be the one that develops technologies and sells them to the world. America will be the one that builds the components that are used throughout the world and here in America. We can create millions of jobs, but we want good paying jobs, jobs that support communities that are sometimes left behind. So we're partnering the environmental community, the labor community, in this bill, the Good Jobs for the 21st Century Energy Act. This bill, for the first time, creates tax credits that explicitly incentivize the creation of energy jobs that meet top-of-the-line labor standards, including living wages, including strong benefits, including significant apprenticeship opportunities. It creates a 10% tax credit for companies that meet these standards, and those standards include giving priority to fossil fuel workers who have been left behind in a changing economy. What types of projects are we talking about? We're talking about wind projects and solar projects and geothermal projects. We're talking about energy for an in-pipe irrigation and in-stream water hydro energy. We're talking about a whole range of ways, including wave power, that phenomenal new experiment being developed and built in Oregon right now. And we're talking about strengthening the manufacturing sector by codifying the Clean Energy Manufacturing Initiative, by creating a clean energy manufacturing hub to bring together stakeholders to strategize over how we create far more of these components in the United States of America and create the jobs here. And it includes manufacturing grants for companies that meet the labor standards who are upgrading their energy efficiency. I'm very pleased that we have significant number of endorsements for this vision. AFL-CIO, the United Steelworkers, the laborers, the utility workers, IBEW, the plumbers and pipe fitters. And we have the National Resource Defense Council, the Union of Concerned Scientists, the National Wildlife Federation, and Data for Progress, and the Blue-Green Alliance that helps bring all of this together. So it's now my pleasure to turn this over to President Trumka. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeff, Senator Merkley, for introducing this legislation and for your continued support of America's working people. And I want to thank you, Senator Hirano and Senator Smith, for your leadership. The AFL-CIO is proud to endorse the Good Jobs for 21st Century Energy Act. This is the right bill at the right time to fight climate change and create the kind of family-sustaining jobs that our country is desperate for. For too long, the corporate right wing, the polluters, and the union busters conspired together to create this false choice. They wanted us to believe that you either had to have a rising wage economy or a clean environment, that they couldn't be created together. Well, that's just simply not true. We can and we must have both. This issue, as you know, is personal to me. I'm a third generation coal miner. Every male in the generations before me has died from black lung disease in the process. So I understand the consequences of burning fossil fuels, but I also know that the workers in the fossil fuel industry have powered this country for generations, and every single American has taken advantage of the fuel that they provided and the progress that was made because of their hard work, their sweat, their blood. They often worked in very, very dangerous conditions. These Americans, quite frankly, have earned every penny and every pension that's out there. So we're ready to do our part, one, to save our planet, build, but our families and our communities cannot be left behind. We need more than vague promises. We need ironclad assurances that the transition to a low-emission future is going to be defined by good union jobs. Senator Merkley's legislation, which includes a strong group of co-sponsors, is a very, very important first step. You see, by tying clean energy tax credits to high road labor standards like prevailing wage and the freedom to form a union, the Good Jobs for 21st Century Energy Act would create a race to the top as opposed to a race to the bottom. And by giving preference to laid-off energy workers and supporting advanced manufacturing, this legislation recognizes that people and places matter, that the communities that we come from matter. The right policies can position working people and our unions to rebuild the middle class. So the two greatest threats to our way of life, income inequality and climate change, can only be solved together. And the labor movement is ready to lead the way, and bills like this one are exactly the approach that we should be taking. Thank you for doing it.
Aloha. It's great to stand here with my colleagues and my friends to support this bill. One would hope that we all recognize it would be a good thing for decision makers to use facts and reality to inform our decisions. But you see, Donald Trump and the Republicans continue to stick their heads in the sand about climate change. They are going to do nothing, but then there are the rest of us who are here wanting to do something. And this bill represents that something, one of those somethings. And one of the greatest things, Rich, is that often the environmental community and the labor community have been at odds on a number of issues. This is a new age now. It's an era where we're all going to come together, and this is a fantastic example of the environmental community and the rest of us and labor coming together. And Rich talked about how important labor and unions were to his family, are to our families, and sure, in my family, I've said this a number of times, I'm an immigrant. My mother came here, very low-paying jobs, and we finally attained economic stability when my mother's workplace unionized. So very important partnership going on here. So you've heard about what this bill does. And I think one of the things that is really important is when we put it out there that we want to create the jobs of the future in clean energy, when you put it out there, it really unleashes innovation, creativity, and yes, responsible risk-taking. Let me give you an example. In Hawaii, I think we set the most ambitious goals to be completely non-reliant on fossil fuels for electricity by the year 2045. Hawaii was the most fossil fuel dependent state in the entire country because there's no coal, there's no oil to drill for. Most of our energy oil was imported. So we set this really ambitious goal. It has unleashed all kinds of programs and innovations to get us to that goal. One example, the island of Kauai. For the first time, they created a group of risk takers, created the first and right now only co-op utility company. And it was really tough going forward because I know the people who began the co-op, and there were a lot of people who said, oh, I don't know how you're going to make this succeed. It's never happened before. But just recently, this first electric co-op in the state installed the largest solar power plus storage facility in the entire world. Not just our country, the entire world, with more to come. And just yesterday, Hawaiian Electric, which is the regulated utility company that pretty much provides the electricity for the other islands, announced an effort to install 900 megawatts of renewable power across the state, enough to power 300,000 homes. So the goal that the state put out is resulting in our electric company, community, people like those who form the KIUC to come forward to move us toward that goal. And that's what this bill is going to do. It's going to provide additional incentives that have huge protection and acknowledgments of the importance of the kind of standards that we want to apply, the kind of standards fought for by unions, wages, conditions, all of that. And that, this is why I think one of the most important aspects of this bill is this partnership between the environmental community and unions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Mustafa Santiago Ali with the National Wildlife Federation, and I'm also the grandson of a coal miner who was a union member. I'm also the son of a machinist, so we have some things in common there, who also shared with me as a young boy how important unions were and how important unions are, because they are actually the backbone of America. They have allowed folks to move out of poverty into the middle class. And when we can merge the incredible work that union workers do with the environment to protect our country, to protect our planet, then we have a winning formula. Now, we know that 40 million people in our country are currently living in poverty. So it would just make sense that we would strengthen one of the organizations, our union workers, who have helped people to move out of poverty into the middle class. We also know that we've got about 27 million folks who are uninsured, and we know that when you have union jobs, then they are going to be fighting for health care as well. And we know that our most vulnerable communities, communities of color, low-income communities, and indigenous populations are ones who are impacted disproportionately, not only from pollution, but also from being underinsured or underinsured, and also who are fighting to be able to make sure that they have jobs that can help them to move from surviving to thriving. We also know that we move forward on this clean energy economy, that we'll also be able to protect those million species that recently in the report said will disappear if we don't move away from fossil fuels. We also know that moving forward on these clean energy jobs can also help us to deal with the 100 to 200,000 people who are dying prematurely every year from air pollution in our country. This gives us an opportunity to have a 21st century paradigm that we're working from, one that makes sure that is inclusive and one that is helping to not only protect the workers that exist, but to give an opportunity, a bridge, if you will, to make sure that those who have been forgotten in the past now have a place where they can also move from surviving to thriving. So thank you, senators, for all of this incredible work. And thank you to everyone who's pushing to make sure that our planet and our communities are protected.
You have been listening to today's announcement for the Good Jobs for the 21st Century Energy Act. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley is one of its sponsors. KBOO Community Radio has three job openings. You can apply by midnight tonight if you're interested in membership, news, or public affairs. KBOO's Aaron Yankee spoke with three current staffers about their jobs and what prospective applicants might want to know about them.
This is the News in Depth, and we're here to talk about the KBOO job openings. My name's Aaron, and I'm the program director. We have three job openings, and so we're going to talk to the people who are currently interim filling those jobs. And right now I'm here with Jenna Yokoyama.
I'm the interim AM News and Public Affairs Director.
What do you do as the AM News and Public Affairs Director?
Oh my goodness, what don't I do? Basically, my purview of programming is from 7 a.m. to noon. So once you tune in during Democracy Now!, then you're hearing my purview of programming. So it's very exciting. I start with Democracy Now! And I go all the way up into the music programming that's at noon. So basically, I manage all the morning programming. I'm in charge of helping people find guests. And so all those authors you hear, I tend to find a lot of those people. And I just make sure that the programming is always running on time. And I make sure that if, you know, a programmer can't come in, that I either help them find someone to be a guest show host or find some other programming that we can find from other community radio stations to play. And I also try to ensure that our programming fits into our programming charter. So I make sure that we are following our KABU mission and making sure we have all that great socially justice-focused programming and programming that is diverse and brings you voices from all the spectrum of human beings.
That's a big job.
It's a fun job. I enjoy it.
Well, what's your favorite part about it?
Well, one, I'm a public affairs person in general as a listener, so I kind of enjoy that. Part of my job is to just listen to what I already enjoy listening to, so that's definitely a perk. But the people that make up the morning programming, you know, it's one thing to listen to programmers on the air, but it's another thing to really get to know people and understand why they choose the topics that they do and to just learn from them. So many of the program hosts have actually been doing radio much longer than me. It's great to learn from them and collaborate with them because we work on what's happening for the membership drive and just talking about how can you improve your show. Understanding people's perspectives too, because when you get to interact with people, you're talking to them before their show airs and finding out what their concerns are and who they think are the important voices as guests for those certain topics. And then also trying to understand what their feedback is from their shows and understanding where they're frustrated, where they feel like they can be doing more, or maybe they feel like they should be talking less, and how can we bring on other voices? It's such a collaborative environment. So definitely, even though you hear the programmers come on every day, they are working with lots of people to bring you really quality programming. So I appreciate being part of that.
So the job is open. What kind of person do you think would make the best kind of morning news and public affairs director?
Okay, well, let's start with the word morning. You need to be a morning person because you got to get here early. So if you enjoy morning, good for you. Also, it's someone who has a lot of radio technical skills because I'm the kind of the troubleshooting person here in the morning, you know, so you have to have some light engineering skills. Plus, people management is a huge aspect of it. So being able to have really good communication skills, also being the kind of person who is willing to sit down and have lots of one-on-one mentoring kind of conversations, and just willing to listen to a lot of people too. That's a huge aspect of my job, is just listening. And then I think being a news person, a news and public affairs person, you just have to be interested because you are the one who has to help people and seek out the guests and understand how we can help shape programming and get ready for the membership drives. So we'll put it down into technical skills, people management, and a love of public affairs.
And love of mornings.
Or a huge coffee fan. You're a person with a serious game plan for the morning.
Excellent. Thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you.
We're now talking to Mike Fotopoulos, who is our current interim membership director.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, Mike. What does that mean that you are the interim membership director?
It's a combination of a bunch of different skills and responsibilities. It's a really challenging but really rewarding job. It's a combination of customer service, data management and analysis, event planning and promotion, organization. It tests every dimension of your brain, for sure.
You say all those things, but what does that actually look like
right. In
your daily life here?
So anyone who's listened to KABU for any extended period of time knows that from time to time, we come on the air and we say, call in now with your support. Give us money to help keep us on the air. That's why KABU is what it is. I'd love to say that it's because of all the awesome people who work and volunteer here, but the reason we're able to work and volunteer here and do what we want to do instead of what some corporate overlord tells us to do is because we are funded by you, the listener. Most of our funding from you, the listener, comes from during our membership drives. A couple times a year, we take anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks to ask you to call in your support. That's a huge undertaking. Those membership drives, they bring in a ton of money, but they also take a huge amount of effort. It's a time that requires a tremendous number of volunteers. There are hundreds of donors who each have their own little individual requests we have to keep track of. Thank you gifts, we have to keep track of the amount of money that we're bringing in. And the planning of those events is within the purview of the membership director, making sure after the fact that we account for everything that has happened, that we make sure everyone is happy, that everyone gets the membership that they paid for, and trying to find ways to make our radio that is fun and compelling more fun and more compelling to as many different people as possible in the hopes that those people will call in and show their support for KBOO.
And our next membership drive starts September
16th.
Yeah. When you say it's a huge undertaking, like, it's 10 weeks out.
Right. We are already in drive prep mode. For most people, what's going on in September isn't even on their radar yet. We're already here at KBOO in drive prep mode. So anyone who wants to apply for the membership director position, don't worry. We got you. We are already preparing. When you start at this position, you will have a membership drive on the horizon, but you will be well underway in the preparation, and it will be a seamless transition into a wonderfully chaotic undertaking.
Yeah, they are really fun. There's a lot of details and a lot of places where people can get stressed out, but we, I feel like, are pretty good at not getting stressed out because of the experiences.
Right. Everything that can possibly happen, and there's a ton of things can and will happen, everything likely already has happened. And there are people around here who've seen them, who've navigated their way through. Every time I've encountered something new, I've either been able to find someone who could tell me like how to get through this, or we've, you know, made up a solution and it's worked out. So you will be in good hands. It's a group effort. It's really like, I'd love to say that I do it, but I don't. It's everyone on staff. It's all the volunteers. It's all the programmers. It's the entire station. And it wouldn't work if it wasn't that way.
So what is your favorite part of being the membership director?
I'm a data geek. So I like the database analysis. Like when someone comes to me and says, hey, Mike, blah, 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 some question about how many donors we have who give in this little idiosyncratic way, and I get to play around in the database, that's when I'm at my happiest. There are aspects of the job that are for completely different personality types than people who are introverted and like to play with numbers. You know, a big part of my job that I love to do is when I am out in the community and people hear that I'm at KBOO and they're like, oh, how do I become a member? You know, I'm everywhere when I'm talking to people and KBOO comes up. That's a chance for me to make my pitch about why you can become a KBOO member. Whenever I'm out of business and I'm wearing my KBOO hoodie and someone mentions that they like KBOO, I initiate a relationship. Maybe we could work with this business, you know, if they share our values. Maybe they might like to provide us with food for our volunteers during our membership drive, for instance. That's a big part of the undertaking for the membership director. And those are things that I never thought I would like, but they're things that in practice, it makes me feel really good to do them. It's a very satisfying job because I get to do so many different things at once.
Since you are currently in the seat, what kind of person do you think would really succeed in this job?
You definitely have to be attentive to detail. You have to want to get things not just right, but perfect. You have to be patient. You have to be good at talking to people and not take things personally. Like, it's my job to let people yell at me when they have a complaint, when we've screwed something up and a member is unhappy about it. I listen to them, I hear them out, and I try to make the situation right. So having good customer service skills is really, really important. Being able to work with a diverse group of people. Of course, anyone who comes through the doors at KBOO, you have to be able to work with a diverse group of people, which is, you know, the most rewarding part of being part of the KBOO community. And you can't do this job alone. You know, volunteers necessarily are going to be working with you. So the ability to train people, the ability to supervise people, the ability to recruit and retain people who are working with you and for you, all really essential parts of this job.
Is there anything else that you want to let the public know about what you do?
I think everyone who does this job should add something to it that we haven't done before. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the next membership director can add to this position. in every job, there's a tremendous amount of inertia, the tendency to just keep doing things the way that they have been done in the past. I'm really excited to see what the next membership director can bring to this position. That is something that we have never done before.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Erin.
This is Lisa Loving, the interim PM News and Public Affairs Director.
Hello.
What does that mean? What do you do for your job?
It means a lot of things. Primarily, I facilitate the 5 o'clock news broadcast every weeknight. It's a one-hour broadcast Monday through Thursday, and then on Friday, it's a half hour. I don't even know a lot of public radio stations that have a one-hour news broadcast, a one-hour local news broadcast. Oregon Public Broadcasting does not have one. So I coordinate a couple dozen volunteers who put together the readers and the audio interviews and the stories for the 5 o'clock news. On top of that, there's also training programs. The news department offers, I want to say, 5 or 6 different trainings in total. In the past few years, some of those have stopped being held. I've been working with you, Erin, to revive all of the trainings. And so I've spent a lot of time rewriting and updating the training materials. And that's a job that will never end. And also hold the trainings, which now we hold during the news cycle. We have a news orientation. We have writing for radio, interviewing, and a couple other things. And they happen while we're getting the news broadcast together. And then the next thing that we really need to do is innovate our social media, innovate our web pages for the KBOO Evening News. We are coming up with a design and a process to be able to take our content that everybody works so hard on because they were trained how to do it, right? You see those two parts. And then the third part, to be able to put it out there so that people can share them. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. Volunteer coordinating being the key. It's my privilege to work with, again, incredible volunteers in the news. They don't even know what to expect sometimes. And they come in and they leave as emerging independent journalists. That's the joyful part, in my opinion, of this job. When it comes to election nights, we do really big live election night events. So those events will draw people who had been volunteers and people from other departments. And so we'll have like maybe 50 people working on live election night. 2020 is going to be a huge year for us. But there's also, of course, a primary election in that year. So we're gearing up for events, literally.
What kind of person would be a good person to apply for this job?
There are two things that are super important. You've got to understand news and you've got to be able to work with volunteers. When you go to journalism school, nobody teaches you how to be a volunteer coordinator, but that is the biggest part of this job. And it is a management aspect, but it's more than managing a commercial news staff or a news staff where everybody's paid. Because the law of 2 feet reigns in the newsroom. If people don't have fun, if they don't like it, they're just going to walk away. So as the KBOO evening news director, it's your job to inspire people and train people, educate them. I always think that my favorite thing is just gluing wings on people's ideas, and that is what I do. Honestly, the most incredible people come in here. They just give and give and give. It's amazing.
Absolutely. Is there anything else that you feel like the public should know about what it is to be the evening news director?
The aspects of this job that are difficult are not necessarily what you might think. As you are running a newsroom, and you're running a newsroom, and it's got, I don't know, 2 to 6 people in it, you're in a fire hose of information. So we're looking all across the world. We don't just do local news. Honestly, I think hyperlocal is overrated. I think it leads to provincial communities. And virtually every local story has a national or international link. Almost every national or international story has a local link. So we look all across the world and we pull stories in, and that can wear the tread off your mind. It really can. It makes you realize how many stories are not really covered, how many stories are rarely covered. And then because we're so interactive with our communities that listen to our broadcast, we're always bringing in community groups, local individuals, elected officials, you start to understand all the news that doesn't really make it out there at all. I mean, we're awash in information in this country, but for real, you don't even hear about all the things that happen. And I'll tell you that because I'm in constant contact with all the nonprofit organizations.
One of the things that makes KBOO different from other media outlets is that our listeners are active listeners. They're not passive listeners. They want to do something about it. So we always look at what people can do, how people can be active. That's definitely a radical thing that most newsrooms don't do. So it is a very, very big lasagna. I'm just putting that out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All three of the job openings that KBOO has right now, the morning news and public affairs director, the membership coordinator, and the PM news and public affairs director, will be open until Thursday, July 18th at 11:59 p.m. More information and how to apply for the jobs is at kboo.fm/employment. I'm Erin Yankee for KBOO News In Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a membership director, a morning news and public affairs director, and an evening news and public affairs director. The deadline to apply for these three full-time positions has been extended to July 18th by 11:59 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For more information on these positions and how to apply, just go to kboo.fm/employment today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rally Against War in Iran and Venezuela on Sunday, July 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salmon Street Fountain Plaza in Waterfront Park in Portland. This march and rally will primarily focus on the possibility of U.S. military intervention in Iran and Venezuela, but also calling attention to the use of sanctions as economic war. Again, that's the Rally Against War in Iran and Venezuela, and Sanctions Kill People Too, on Sunday, July 28th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Salmon Street Fountain Plaza in Waterfront Park, downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rally Against War in Iran and Venezuela.